Today, our event is, should U.S. courts ignore international law? And our speaker is Professor David Moore. He's coming here from Brigham Young University. He is a scholar in U.S. foreign relations law, international law, and international human rights. His publications appear in several law reviews and journals. Prior to becoming a professor, Professor Moore clerked for Justice Samuel Alito during the U.S. Supreme Court's 2007 term, and then previously clerked for Justice Alito on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit from 2000-2001. From 1996 to 2000, he was an honor program trial attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice. Now I'll turn it over to Professor Moore.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for coming. I might take this out so I can stand to the side of this. Is that going to have problems with our video? Okay. Right, so thanks, Chris, and thanks for the opportunity to speak on this topic of whether U.S. courts should ignore international law. Or put another way, is international law U.S. law that courts can reach out to and apply, like federal statutes, the Constitution, etc.? This has become a matter of significant debate, I think because of the expansion of international law and our interaction with the international legal system. When we talk about this issue, there are two concerns that generally are implicated, and often these are cast as mutually exclusive and as competing concerns. One is a concern for the effectiveness of international law. So one of the general criticisms of international law is that it lacks compulsory enforcement. There is not a judiciary on the international plane that looks like the U.S. judiciary that can enforce violations of international law when they occur. Now, that is changing to some degree. We're seeing a proliferation of fora where international law issues can be resolved. But at the same time, we're nowhere near the existence of an international judiciary that has the sort of enforcement authority that our domestic judiciary has. And so if we are concerned about the effectiveness of international law, presumably we would want to give it a prominent role in our system, where it could, like other sources of domestic law, achieve some of the compulsory enforcement that's lacking internationally. On the other hand, we have concerns about proper governance. And this issue raises questions such as, should other states have a role in creating the law that binds domestically? If so, should there be some sort of filter before that law becomes binding in the domestic sphere? And if we think there should be a filter, who should provide it? Should it be the state? Should it be the federal government within the federal government? Should it be Congress? Should it be the court? Should it be the executive? So this concern is concern for our traditional lawmaking structures and whether international law needs to go through those before it becomes binding domestically. And again, as I said, often these are cast as mutually exclusive concerns. I don't ultimately think they are, but we'll see how these concerns motivate or play out in the debate on this topic. So when we talk about international law, we're talking about two main sources. How many have taken an international law class? So a few of us have, okay. When we talk about international law, we're talking about two main sources of law. One, treaties, which we're generally familiar with. These are agreements that are negotiated among states and formally ratified by them. So states decide whether to consent and formally give their consent and assume obligations under these agreements. Things like the UN Charter, the Kyoto Protocol, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Again, things we're generally familiar with. The other source of international law is customary international law. And this is significantly different than treaties. So customary international law is not something that states formally negotiate. And it's not something that they formally ratify. Instead, customary international law emerges as states begin to behave in a particular way. They begin when there emerges a general and consistent practice among states that they come to feel is legally binding upon them. So before we had treaties on diplomatic and consular relations, we had customary international law principles that had developed about how one treats ambassadors or consular officials from another country. And again, this wasn't negotiated or ratified in a treaty. It emerged as a principle of customary international law. So when we're talking about the role that international law should have domestically, we're looking at these two sources. Starting with treaties then, and whether they are part of U.S. law, we fortunately get some guidance from the Constitution on this question. So the Constitution says the President with the Senate can make treaties, and then in the Supremacy Clause says that treaties, like the Constitution and statutes, are supreme federal law, and that state courts are bound to enforce them. Looking at the Supremacy Clause on its face, one would might think that whenever a treaty claim is presented to U.S. courts, they are bound to enforce the treaty obligations. That is not the case, however. Early on, in the early 1800s, in a case called Foster v. Nielsen, the Supreme Court recognized that treaties are of two types. Some treaties are self-executing and can be immediately enforced in our courts. Other treaties or agreements are non-self-executing, meaning that they need to be executed or implemented before our courts can enforce them. And so a non-self-executing treaty is not domestic law that can be, you're welcome to come in. Okay. Are not agreements that can be immediately enforced in U.S. courts. Instead, Congress has to pass implementing legislation to execute our international obligations and render them enforceable domestic law. Well, the existence of this doctrine has generated significant debate among legal scholars. And I would say the majority of legal scholars who look at this question claim that non-self-execution is inconsistent with the Supremacy Clause. When the Supremacy Clause says all treaties are supreme law of the land, the argument goes they must be enforceable in U.S. courts. And these scholars also contest the practice of ratifying a treaty under the condition that it be non-self-executing. So the Senate, in deciding to give its consent to a treaty, will sometimes include a declaration that says, we understand that this treaty is non-self-executing, meaning once it's ratified, it's not going to be immediately enforceable in all our courts. There's going to have to be another step, some legislation from Congress, to render this enforceable. And again, the argument goes that this is inconsistent with the Supremacy Clause, which declares treaties to be the supreme law of the land. Well, the Supreme Court had a chance in 2008 to look at this doctrine and wade into this debate over the proper scope of the doctrine of non-self-execution in a case called Medellin v. Texas, which actually was handed down while I was clerking at the court. And it's this interesting case where Medellin is a Mexican national. He is believed to have participated in the torture and murder of a U.S. drug enforcement agent in Mexico. The U.S. is unsuccessful in negotiating with the Mexican government to get him extradited to the U.S., so the DEA has this brilliant plan to have him kidnapped in Mexico and brought to the United States. So Sosa, another Mexican national, abducts Medellin is a Mexican national who is sentenced on death row. I'm talking about Sosa, which we'll get to. Medellin is a Mexican national who committed a capital offense and was sentenced to death in Texas. He is not alone among Mexican national sitting on death row in the United States. And he's not alone among those nationals in that he was not notified when he was arrested in the U.S. that he could contact the Mexican consulate. The Vienna Convention on Consular Relations secures that right or obligates the U.S. to inform him of that right, and he had not been so informed. Well, Mexico took the case involving Medellin and other Mexican nationals to the International Court of Justice, which is the UN's principal judicial body, and argued to the ICJ that the U.S. had violated this treaty obligation. And asked the ICJ to overturn the convictions and sentences of these Mexican nationals who had not received their treaty rights. Well, the ICJ agreed with Mexico, in this case called Avena, and told the U.S. not to overturn the convictions and sentences, but said you are obligated to review and reconsider the convictions and sentences of these Mexican nationals. The problem was that Medellin's opportunity to claim that his treaty rights had been violated had already passed. It was past the time limits that Texas procedural law imposes for raising this claim. He, however, argued that this ICJ judgment preempts Texas procedural law, such that he should be able to bring a habeas action and get relief based on this ICJ judgment. So the question ultimately before the court was, is this judgment self-executing, such that it is federal law and would preempt any Texas procedural law to the contrary? Ultimately, the court concluded that it was not. It was non-self-executing. So Texas default law applied, and Medellin was not able to rely on this ICJ judgment to get relief. Beyond that, the court went through and gave some sense of how we decide this question of whether a treaty is self-executing. And this has been an issue that has confused scholars and courts for some time, because essentially since Foster v. Nielsen back in the early 1800s, the court hasn't told us a lot about this doctrine. And so this is the most the Supreme Court has ever told us in Medellin. And what the court indicates is that the question of whether a treaty is self-executing and immediately enforceable hinges in large measure on the intent of the political branches. When the President and Senate decided to consent to this treaty, did they intend that it be self-executing and immediately enforceable in our courts? If so, then it can be so enforced. If not, then we need some additional action by the federal government before it becomes enforceable. The court also looked at the nature of the language in the treaty. So the obligation with regard to the ICJ judgment was that the U.S. undertake to comply with that judgment. And the court said, that's not the sort of language that suggests that the obligation is immediately enforceable. That suggests that there are a variety of options the U.S. might take other than enforcement immediately in our courts, such that this doesn't look like something that is self-executing. The court looked to see how other countries treated their obligations with regard to the ICJ and concluded no country enforces those judgments in its domestic courts automatically, suggesting again this probably wasn't what we signed up to do when we ratified the treaty. The court looked at the practical consequences of doing this, noting that again, Mexico had asked that these convictions and sentences be overturned. And that's something the ICJ could have done in its judgment, say, we're just overturning the death convictions or capital convictions and death sentences of these Mexican nationals. And the court said, if we treat these judgments as self-executing, well, we have no opportunity to sort of look behind that judgment, say, is this really appropriate? Should we really be overturning the conviction and sentences of these capital defendants? And the court suggested no. And if it's non-self-executing, we sort of have some buffer there to decide how we're going to comply. looked at the foreign relations effect, alternative means of enforcement. They're looking at the fact that generally, a failure to comply with an ICJ judgment results in a referral to the Security Council. That was the anticipated means of enforcing these judgments, not in domestic courts. And the court said, the Security Council, of course, we have a veto. So the President and Senate, when they signed on to this, presumably assumed they would have an opportunity at the Security Council to weigh in, and not that these judgments would be immediately enforced in domestic courts and preempt the opportunity to exercise the veto. So based on these considerations, the court concludes this judgment is not self-executing, and going forward, these are the sort of things we ought to think about in determining whether a treaty is domestic law or something, or an international obligation that U.S. courts sort of must ignore in when claims are brought based on the treaty. All right, turning then to the status of customary international law, this other source of international law, and what U.S. courts should do with this body of law. Here we don't have the same guidance from the Constitution. The Constitution mentions customary international law once in saying that Congress will have authority to define and punish violations of the law of nations, or customary international law. So there's some sense in the Constitution that Congress will have a role in incorporating this body of law. But customary international law is not Constitution, statute, treaties, the three things mentioned in the Supremacy Clause. And so it's not clear where it fits in to our domestic system. At the same time, the Supreme Court a number of times has said customary international law is part of our law. So the question has become how? It's not one of these supreme sources listed in the Supremacy Clause. How is it part of our law? The suggestion has been that it is federal common law, that it is a body of law that federal courts can reach out to and apply of their own without any statute or constitutional authorization to do so. And this issue has generated two main positions in the legal academy. The majority position, which focuses on these concerns for the effectiveness of international law, giving customary international law a prominent role in our system, maintains that customary international law is federal common law. Again, that the federal courts can reach out and apply this body of law, and they don't need some sort of statutory authorization or to find some constitutional hook for doing so. And again, if this is true, then we give international law a prominent place in U.S. law. Courts can enforce it, and it gets some of that enforcement that it doesn't get internationally. The minority view among legal scholars has been termed the revisionist view, modern position view by its opponents, saying this is a modern invention, it's never been like this. The revisionist view by its opponents saying you're revising history, it's always been like this. That view has maintained that courts can reach out to customary international law. They don't have to ignore it, but only to the extent the Constitution or Congress have authorized the courts to apply this body of law. So the notion here focuses on issues of proper governance. This court should not be able to reach out and say, for example, this principle is a principle of international family law. Therefore, states, you cannot order your family law in a way inconsistent with this norm. We only get that if Congress comes in or the Constitution somehow authorizes the federal courts to reach out and apply this body of law. So this revisionist view focuses again on these proper governance concerns. This issue has not been debated solely in the academy. It has a very practical context as well. And that context is international human rights litigation. So if customary international law is federal common law, it would be easier to bring international human rights lawsuits or claims in the United States. And particularly because we have this statute on the books that reaches back to the founding. The Alien Tort Statute was enacted In 1789, as part of the first Judiciary Act, when Congress was creating the federal court system and giving it jurisdiction, and says the federal district courts get to have jurisdiction over claims by aliens, non-U.S. nationals, for violations of customary international law, as well as for violations of treaties. It appears that Congress passed this statute at the founding because there had been some problems where foreign diplomats, for example, had been assaulted and the federal government didn't have authority to respond. They were left in the position of calling upon the states to please prosecute or provide some remedy for this international law violation, which was causing foreign affairs problems. So we get more foreign affairs authority in the Constitution, and the first Congress passes this statute to say our courts can respond to these violations. Well, this statute, again, is enacted in 1789, but lays dormant until about 1980. And in 1980, the Human Rights Bar realizes that this is a great vehicle for getting international human rights litigation into U.S. courts because it allows aliens to come in and sue for violations of customary international law. So the big case that reinvigorated this statute was Falardiga in the Second Circuit, where we had Paraguayan plaintiffs, a father and daughter, who sued a Paraguayan police official or former police official for his torture of their brother and son in Paraguay. So Paraguayan plaintiffs, Paraguayan defendants, the underlying violation occurs in Paraguay, and the claim is that this Paraguayan police official has violated a customary international law norm against official torture. Well, the Second Circuit looks at this and says, this fits with the language of the Alien Tort Statute. We've got aliens bringing a claim, sounding a tort, claiming a violation of customary international law. Again, this prohibition on official torture. There was a more fundamental problem, however. The Second Circuit had to assure itself that the Constitution allowed this sort of litigation. Again, litigation by foreign nationals against foreign nationals about something that occurred in a foreign country where the violation is based on international law. Well, Article 3 of the Constitution says the federal judicial power gets to extend to certain types of suits, things like diversity suits, but we didn't have that here. Really, the only constitutional basis for the federal courts to hear this was if customary international law were U.S. law. And the Second Circuit says it is. Customary international law is part of the federal common law, such that these suits can by and against foreign nationals about something that happened in another country arise under federal law for constitutional purposes. So the Second Circuit treats customary international law as federal common law, at least for jurisdictional purposes. And this leads to a sort of waves of litigation under the Alien Tort Statute. Initially, the suits look like this. Suits against foreign officials for a violation of a customary international law norm. In a later case, the Second Circuit concludes that some international law norms can be violated by individuals. You don't have to be a state actor to violate international law. And this opens up the Alien Tort Statute to use for in suits against corporations. So we get a second wave of suits against corporations like Nike, Pfizer, all kinds of corporations for their complicity in human rights violations in other countries. The third wave then is suits against our own officials, U.S. officials, and particularly officials involved in the war on terror. So during the Bush administration, this then was a vehicle to bring lawsuits against executive officials for violations of customary international law. So again, not just a theoretical matter. To the extent customary international law is U.S. law, then it's easier to bring these suits against U.S. officials. Now, we've got immunity questions, we've got questions about whether customary international law actually binds the executive. It doesn't bind Congress, for example. Congress can pass statutes that are inconsistent with customary international law. So there are additional questions involved, but this is one of the hurdles that stands in the way of using customary international law to hold our own officials accountable. So again, practically very important. Now, Philardega then again says customary international law is federal common law for jurisdiction purposes. What Philardega did not answer, though it's interpreted by some as providing the authority on this question, is where we get the cause of action. This you need, when you go to court, not only a court that has authority to hear the type of case, but you need a cause of action, a set of facts that the law recognizes as entitling you to a remedy. So there was this additional question of, okay, we've got jurisdiction over these alien tort statute claims. Is there a cause of action for these violations of customary international law? And we get a split on that question. Again, courts, looking back to Philardega, which doesn't address this question, but Philardega lets the litigation go forward, and so they say, well, Philardega concludes that the alien tort statute provides the cause of action, or delegates to the federal courts the authority to create causes of action, or federal courts just have this authority to create causes of action. A number of courts, commentators saying there is that ability to find a cause of action for these customary international law-based claims. That view is then disputed by Judge Bork in a fractured D.C. Circuit opinion involving a situation where terrorists in Israel had hijacked a bus and killed a number of people. And he concludes that this statute does not provide a cause of action. If there's going to be a cause of action for these international human rights or customary international law-based claims, Congress has to provide it. Well, Congress does step in following Tellerin and passes a statute called the Torture Victim Protection Act and says, we do want to create a cause of action in our courts for official torture and extrajudicial killing. So a couple of the customary international law prohibitions that are out there. And suggests in its legislative history that it's also supportive of Philardega and how the alien tort statute has been interpreted. Well, finally, the Supreme Court gets to step in, and this is the case I had begun to describe earlier, where we've got a Mexican national who the U.S. is trying to get a hold of to face criminal charges. And again, unsuccessful in negotiating with the Mexican government. So DEA approves this plan whereby Sosa, another Mexican national, abducts Alvarez Machin in Mexico and brings him to the U.S. to face charges. The district court dismisses these charges, concludes it was wild speculation that Alvarez Machin was involved in the torture and murder of this DEA agent. So he is freed and returns to Mexico. He then brings suit in U.S. court under the Alien Tort Statute, claiming that Sosa has violated a customary international law norm against arbitrary detention. Well, this again gives the Supreme Court a chance to look at this statute and look at customary international law and tell us, is it, or at least give us some suggestion as to whether it is in fact U.S. law that U.S. courts should be applying. Most commentators who have looked at Sosa read it as endorsing the modern position. Again, the modern position being the view that federal courts can reach out and apply customary international law as federal law in a common law format. And I think part of what this conclusion is based on is the fact that the Sosa court does allow some of this litigation to proceed. So it doesn't cut off litigation under the Alien Tort Statute entirely. At the same time, my view is that these commentators reach this conclusion because they confuse the two questions that we have been looking at. One, the question of whether the Alien Tort Statute creates a cause of action for violations of customary international law, and two, whether customary international law is of its own federal common law. On this first question, the court very easily concluded that this statute only provides jurisdiction. It does not create a cause of action. And here the court was unanimous. They looked at this statute, they said this was part of the First Judiciary Act, which was creating the federal courts. It spoke back then in terms of cognizance, which was a term that referred to jurisdiction. Say, the First Congress knew the difference between jurisdiction and causes of action. So it's very clear to all of us that the Alien Tort Statute only provides jurisdiction. However, the court said, we are going to recognize, and here the court split with six justices taking this position, that we are going to recognize some continuing authority in the federal courts to recognize customary international law-based causes of action. So we recognize some authority in the federal courts going forward to take customary international law norms from international law and fit them to a cause of action in the United States. The reason the court does this is because of what the first Congress had on its mind. And so I think the analysis that leads to this conclusion on the cause of action suggests that instead of adopting the modern position, the court is more comfortable with the revisionist view on this second and more fundamental question of whether customary international law is federal common law and therefore a body of law that U.S. federal courts can apply. And the reason I say that is, again, largely because of the court's focus on congressional intent. Under the modern position view, you didn't need authorization from Congress or the Constitution to apply customary international law. And so under the modern position view, it seems the court could have simply said, there is this norm of customary international law out there that federal courts can continue to recognize. But instead, unanimous court looked back to 1789 and tried to understand what Congress meant, what Congress intended in enacting this statute, and said Congress, when it passed this statute, believed that once it provided jurisdiction, the federal courts would hear claims based on customary international law. And the reason Congress thought that was because we lived in a pre-Erie world. Going back to that first year, before Erie, we believed there was a body of law out there, general law, that was not enacted by anyone. It was sort of part of the nature. And federal courts could reach out and, using reason, discern what the general law said, just as the state courts could. Neither of them were bound by each other's interpretations or identification of general law. And customary international law was part of that general law. So the first Congress would have said, here's your jurisdiction, understood that the federal courts would reach out to this body of general law, which included customary international law, and identify causes of action. And in fact had three principles of customary international law on its mind, the court presumes. These, a norm against offenses against ambassadors, the norm against piracy, and the norm against violation of safe passage, when you guaranteed a right for a foreign national or entity to be in your country. And said Congress, that's what it was thinking about when it passed this statute. And again, it understood that once it provided jurisdiction, the federal courts could reach out to this body of law and apply it and recognize causes of action or enforce causes of action based on this law. However, so it's based on what Congress had done that the court says we're going to recognize some continuing authority to do this. And again, that seems consistent with the revisionist view that we find our authority with regard to customary international law in the political branches, in what Congress authorizes or in what the Constitution authorizes. I think this position becomes more clear when the court says, going forward, federal courts, the causes of action you recognize based on customary international law are not only, that authority is not only grounded in what Congress had on its mind, it's limited by what Congress had on its mind. And so the court says, federal courts, you can only recognize customary international law norms that look like the ones Congress was thinking about. Piracy, rights of ambassadors, violation of safe conduct. In other words, the cause of the customary international law norms you get to recognize have to be as well defined and internationally as well accepted as those. So not only the authority, but the scope of the authority the court recognizes with regard to customary international law is defined by congressional intent, which again seems like a revisionist perspective. We look to the political branches to decide to what extent customary international law is available as domestic law. The court specifically talks about Erie and how it changed our notions of common law making and how federal courts are not supposed to be common law courts and are not supposed to have authority to sort of reach out and create a new body of law. And that if they did, in the area of customary international law, this would have foreign relations problems, because our courts are not our primary conductors of foreign affairs. That's Congress and the President who conduct our foreign affairs, generally. And even the court even mentions Erie's federalism concerns, that if federal courts reach out and apply this body of customary international law generally, or have broad authority to do so, it would be inconsistent with federalism. The federal courts would be trumping state law by reference to this body of customary international law, potentially in broad areas, and they wouldn't be going through our normal lawmaking process to do this. So the court acknowledges some federalism concerns here as well, again suggesting that the court feels more comfortable with the revisionist position. Well, the court again tells lower courts, these are the sort of things to think about when you're deciding whether to recognize a customary international law-based claim. And as I mentioned, intent of the political branch is a sort of a first and foremost. That's the source of your authority under the Alien Tort Statute, and it is limited, your authority is limited by what the political branches were thinking. Again, you can only recognize customary international law-based norms that are as well defined and as well as accepted as what Congress had on its mind. The court looked at a few other things also to guide this question of when courts should be able to reach out to customary international law. One thing they looked at is the practical consequences of doing so. And here, in the Alvarez case, they said the consequences are just too broad. Alvarez has claimed there's a customary international law norm against arbitrary detention. And the detention he suffered was essentially being detained for about a day by someone who didn't have authority to detain him. The court says if we recognize that as a norm of customary international law that's actionable in our courts, every time anyone in the world is detained by a police officer who lacks authority to detain them, they will have a claim in our courts. And if it doesn't have to be a police officer, if there doesn't have to be state action, if it can just be a private citizen who detains, well, then we open our doors even further. They say that's just too much for us to do through common law. Congress could do something like that and open our courts to those sorts of claims, but that's not something we should be doing. So look at the consequences of recognizing a common law-based claim. They look at the foreign relations effects of incorporating customary international law or fitting it to a U.S. cause of action. And here they specifically mentioned some litigation involving companies that had done business with apartheid South Africa. There was Alien Tort Statute litigation proceeding against them. And the court says we've got to be sensitive to the foreign affairs implications of our courts enforcing this body of customary international law. And in this particular case, we recognize that South Africa adopted a different response to apartheid. Recognizing the scope, I think, of the abuses committed during apartheid, South Africa adopted a truth and reconciliation approach. rather than authorizing individuals who are harmed by this regime to come in and individually litigate the harm they suffered, so we are going to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And a commission like that essentially brings in witnesses and tries to discover the truth of the horrors that occurred during apartheid. And the commission might grant amnesty, for example, for people to come forward and really tell the truth about what they did or what they suffered during this regime. And the country sort of responds and purges the injustice of what had happened through this approach rather than going case by case and litigating each of the human rights violations. And the court says, if we then open up our courts to these individual suits, we are undercutting the policy South Africa has adopted, and that's going to create foreign relations problems. We need to be sensitive to that in deciding whether to apply customary international law as U.S. law. And the court also mentions alternative means of enforcement. Is there somewhere else that this claim should be brought, or at least should they have to exhaust a remedy that's more local before they come and bring the suit by Paraguayans against Paraguayans about what happened in Paraguay into U.S. courts? But when you compare then what the Sosa and Medellin courts have done, it seems to me there's obvious overlap in the considerations these courts are using and prescribing for lower courts to use in deciding what role international law should have domestically. The court does not acknowledge this, or it doesn't say these are the same sort of considerations, but you look at the opinions and we've got this focus on the intent of the political branches in both contexts. We've got the court looking to see how well-defined the treaty obligation is, or how well-defined the customary international law norm is, whether other countries have assumed a self-executing obligation, whether other countries recognize this customary international law norm. What's going to happen if we recognize these, and in particular, what's going to happen with our foreign affairs if we enforce this treaty as domestic law or incorporate this norm of customary international law? Are there other places this principle of international law should be enforced? And I think you look at these considerations and they reflect the separation of powers vision in which the courts are not the leaders in deciding whether international law will be part of our law. They reflect a separation of powers perspective in which those questions are largely left, at least in the first instance, to the political branches. The political branches want to incorporate these principles as principles of domestic law and render them enforceable by our courts. Well, let me close with a few observations. What does this mean, and is this a good place for us to be at, what the Supreme Court appears to be doing? And I think the first thing this suggests is that the academic position on international law in the U.S. legal system is not where the U.S. is going. Again, the majority position was antagonistic toward non-self-execution of treaties, whereas in Medellin, the court adopts a broad perspective on non-self-execution. I think it's generally understood that post-Medellin, more treaties are going to be non-self-executing and require implementation by Congress before they're enforceable in our courts. Similarly, the court in Sosa does not endorse this notion that federal courts can reach out to any customary international law norm and apply it in the federal court system. Whereas, again, the majority position had been that this body of law was generally available to the federal courts. I think this means that to the extent we want international law to play a prominent role in our system, the avenue for achieving that is the political branches, not the courts. So it's we should go to Congress and not the courts to try and get international law incorporated or rendered part of domestic law to the extent we feel that's appropriate. Now, I think some might suggest that Leaving it to the political branches means it's not going to happen. And certainly it's easier to get one federal judge to incorporate a principle of international law than it may be to go through our normal constitutional lawmaking process. At the same time, we've had some examples where Congress has incorporated international law and done so in a prominent way. So the Hamdan case, for example, involving the president's use of military commissions to try detainees, involved a situation where the court turned to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which Congress had enacted, and found that Congress had said, "President, you cannot use military commissions in ways that violate the customary international law of war." So Congress had taken those customary international law principles and used them as a restriction on the president's authority to use military commissions. And on that basis, the court concludes these commissions are illegal. I think we can look and see that incorporation by the political branches is in fact possible and has occurred. I also think that this direction that the court seems to be going is a positive one. One, because I think it is more coherent. Under the modern position view, it was odd that customary international law was generally available to the federal courts to apply. Notwithstanding the fact that customary international law is not a body of law that we formally negotiate or ratify, and notwithstanding the fact that it doesn't appear in the Supremacy Clause, while at the same time, treaties which we do negotiate and formally consent to and which appear in the Supremacy Clause were not always available to the federal courts to apply. I think this approach that the court appears to be taking leads to a result where treaties are going to be more enforceable in our courts than customary international law. And I think that's appropriate given how treaties are made and formally consented to by our political branches and given the fact that treaties are mentioned in the Supremacy Clause. Finally, I think this direction is a good one because I think it works in a combination of these two concerns that we started with: the concern for the effectiveness of international law and the concern for proper governance and respecting our constitutional lawmaking processes. So again, international law can play a prominent role in the domestic legal system, but it does that as a result of our constitutional processes for creating law. So as a result of Congress looking at this question and enacting statutes or the treaty makers entering into treaties that are immediately enforceable in our courts. So I think ultimately we can achieve both these objectives. We can respect or take account of our concerns for proper governance. We can give international law an effective place as domestic law, but we do so in harmony, again, by using the political process and our normal constitutional structures as the filter for making international law domestic law. Questions? Yeah?
When a nation joins an international body, does it, in a sense, lose part of its sovereignty and in that become more like a state, and then the international body itself becomes like a federal body? Is that?
Yes, I think there. Well, it doesn't necessarily always happen that way. So international organizations are of many stripes. Some have compulsory authority. Actually, very few have authority to bind the states' parties, in part because they are formed as a result of consent, and states aren't always willing to consent to that. So the Security Council is probably the best example of an international entity that has authority to bind member states. Even the General Assembly has just authority to recommend things to member states. Other organizations have something short of that, where they can adopt rules, for example, the state has to opt out of or they will become binding. So it sort of stacks the cards in favor of the international organization. And others just make recommendations, and the state decides whether to consent to those or not. So there's a real spectrum in the nature of international organizations. To the extent an international organization does have this compulsory authority, I mean, I think it is like creating a federal or a supranational organization. I think one of the differences is that it's not done through a constitutional process. And so the way we go about doing those things is usually through treaty, which doesn't have the same stature in our domestic legal system as, say, the Constitution. And so there's that difference as well. The way we go about it is through a mechanism that doesn't have the same clout as the Constitution.
So when the U.S. is a P5 country, it's bound then by the Security Council? And so does that, if it's bound, does that already make it the law of the land, so to speak?
Okay, no. So for a couple of reasons. You're right, the U.S. is a member of a permanent member of the Security Council, has a veto. If the U.S. signs on, or if the Security Council is able to do something, it's because the U.S. has consented, or at least abstained. That does produce something that's binding internationally. But the question is, how does that international obligation become domestic law? And there are a variety of ways that we create and enforce law domestically. So we don't always create an opportunity for people to enforce it in the court system. We might have administrative agencies impose fines, for example, or use some sort of administrative process. So just because even something is law domestically does not mean it's judicially enforceable. And certainly just because something is binding on us internationally does not mean it's immediately enforceable and trumps all other law, federal or domestic. And that is consistent with international law. So international law says you are bound internationally, but generally does not address how, as a matter of domestic law, you are going to be bound. Because it recognizes there are 190 plus domestic legal systems, and there's not one answer to that question. So the general understanding is international law can bind us as to other states, but generally does not dictate or even try to dictate what that means domestically. Does that make sense? So, and that question, maybe taking a step back, implicates sort of two structures for ordering relationships between domestic and international law. So on one hand, we have monist states, and say there probably aren't any pure monist states that say international law and domestic law are part of the same body of law, and international law is supreme. And on the other hand, dualist states would say, no, they're two separate bodies of law. They address two separate things, right? International law addresses relations between states. Domestic law addresses relations between citizens or citizens with their state. So there are two separate legal frameworks, and domestic law is ultimately supreme. Domestic law ultimately dictates what role international law gets to play. And I would say generally the U.S. is more of a dualist state than a monist, and states generally fall somewhere on that spectrum. Yeah?
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
The first one is, when you talk of federal common law,
right,
you speak of it as if it's an accepted concept by all. Is that really the case?
It is accepted that there is some federal common law making authority. The scope of that authority is highly debated. Though I think these days the trend has probably been, at least in the scholarly literature, to recognize more limitation on federal common law than maybe had previously been recognized. So when Erie comes along, it says there is no general federal common law, meaning we don't believe there's a body of law in the ether that federal courts can resort to, but it doesn't eliminate the possibility of federal courts creating through common law processes some federal law. So areas where it's not been terribly controversial until maybe as of late, Admiralty and Maritime, the federal courts have created common law in that area. Though more recently, Congress has stepped in significantly into that area, and so we have more political branch created law than we used to. Interstate disputes, where we say we can't turn to the law of Colorado and Arizona in determining water rights. It wouldn't be fair to resort to one of their laws. Well, the federal courts can create common law in that area. So I would say it's generally recognized that there are limited areas where federal common law making is still appropriate. But again, the scope of that authority is debated and is part of this debate, right? The modern position thinking there's a lot more room for common law making with regard to customary international law than the revisionist view.
So it's not absolutely accepted by all.
Right.
Such a thing. Because I've heard debates in the past, some people believing there's no such thing as federal common law or very limited areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally they have to recognize very limited areas, because what do you do with interstate disputes, for example? The Supreme Court has jurisdiction to hear these. They do come up. If there's no federal common law out there, we just don't have any law to apply. So I think there's some recognition that there are narrow areas. Now, those can be tied more or less to the Constitution and statutes, and so they may be more or less controversial as well.
Second question is, when you talk about both views of the customary international law, both say, whether you take the revisionist out of the modern, at least what you put up there, both say the federal courts may use this. Does that also mean the federal courts may not use that? That
yeah.
The federal court can actually choose whether to go with that customary international law or not?
I would say under the modern position view, that's probably the case, that this is available as a body of federal common law, which suggests that the federal courts have some authority, since it is common law and judges are the ultimate authority on that. Under the revisionist view, I would say the answer depends on the nature of the authorization by the Constitution or the political branches. So if the political branches say you must, for example, the piracy statute makes it a crime to commit piracy as defined by international law. In that context, you're directed to look to international law, and I think you must do it. So I think it would depend on the nature of the authorization.
But somehow, if there's a statute or something like that, you're kind of taking it out of the world of customary international law and bringing it more into the world of our domestic.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. We domesticate it, we incorporate it through that statutory process.
And my final question was, you spoke of the U.S. dealing with all of these issues. Are other states dealing with the same issues, different issues? Is it more accepted?
Yes, and I think there's a range there. I guess I don't know for sure if there's a majority position. You do really get a range on this dualist monist spectrum. And even those countries that are more monist have often done it in ways that are consistent with dualism, meaning they'll say something like in their constitution that international law has this standing. Well, that gives international law a generic entrance into the domestic legal system, but it's again through a constitutional process. So it's sort of dualist in mechanism with a monist result. So again, I couldn't say sort of generically this is how countries are doing it. I really do feel, my sense is they really are on a spectrum. Again, with some saying as a matter of constitutional law, we'll incorporate international law. And I think these probably tend to be countries, sort of developing countries, and I think often the incentive is to communicate to the rest of the world, we want to be players, and we want to be trusted in the international community. I don't always see it as a real commitment. You look around the world, and I think it's hard to identify a lot of countries who do better than the U.S. in actually implementing a lot of the norms that are part of international law, even if we have a dualist system. And do some of this stuff as a matter of domestic and not pure international law.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, thanks for the questions.
You mentioned that several points, cases that involve you know, foreign parties on both sides of litigation in federal courts.
Right.
Has there been much of a debate on whether it's proper for that to take place in our federal courts? And if, well, either way, is there any real limitation to foreign parties litigating in our courts?
Yeah, so yes, there has been debate, and that debate hinges in part, at least, on this question of whether customary international law is federal law. Because if it's not, there is no constitutional basis for for federal courts to hear these sorts of claims, because they don't involve diversity or any of the other types of cases that are included in Article 3, which defines the outer limits of judicial power. So there definitely has been debate on that, both on a constitutional level and on a more practical level. So we have questions about whether U.S. courts should really be acting as sort of world courts. And I remember, this is slightly different, being an American Society of International Law meeting and an international law authority from England sort of saying, keep your jurisdiction to yourself, right? We don't want you hearing the cases about what's happening in our country. It relates to more issues than just this, right? But there's sort of that thought. There have been criticism that this results in plaintiff's diplomacy. Plaintiffs get to decide which countries we're targeting, which countries our courts are going to sit in judgment on, rather than having the executive make those determinations. On the other hand, the opposing arguments would be, where else are these plaintiffs going to go? Some of these people have suffered really atrocious human rights violations, and our courts ought to be available to provide justice. And even if we can't provide a remedy that's enforceable, even if it's a $4 billion judgment against someone who neither has that money nor is within the United States and subject to the authority of our courts, or at least the immediate reach for execution purposes, this does send an important message to the world that these sort of violations are unacceptable. So there are positions on both sides of this. And again, my feeling is we can accommodate that. Right? Congress can do things like pass the Torture Victim Protection Act, which says we want our courts to be available if you are someone who has suffered torture or extrajudicial killing at the hands of another country. Now, that statute happens to be a little bit hypocritical in that it doesn't allow for claims against the U.S., or only against other countries who have engaged in torture and extrajudicial killing. But I think that's an example of a situation where you can accommodate these concerns by going through the political process, where we can debate the pros and cons of this entails. Yeah.
So you're saying that the U.S. courts are moving in a certain direction with international law in the U.S. Do you think that has implications for how the U.S. is interacting internationally?
Yes, I think so, but I'm not. I mean, I think clearly so, but I'm not sure which direction the implications go. So I think for those like this scholar from England, I think, really great if you will just limit yourself to applying international law in more narrow circumstances and not open yourselves up to cases from around the world. Again, there's the opposing view of, wait, but you're not respecting or enforcing international law in a way that promotes its development. So there would be those who would criticize that restriction, both as a matter of international law and as a matter of domestic law. I mean, you can certainly make arguments under the Constitution that treaties ought to get more play in U.S. courts than Medellin suggests, for example. So I think it's clear, but I think the audience may respond differently depending on their interests.
Yeah. You touched on the issue with military commissions. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on what effect any further international law, being whether we're a dualist country or not, implemented into our system, what effect, pros and cons, that will have on our military.
You know, that is a good question. I'm not sure I have enough expertise to know, but I was, we hired a new professor recently whose expertise is in the law of war, who spent years in the Army. And one of the things he said that was interesting to me was that the Army wants clarity. They want sort of certainty about the extent to which international law governs or how we're going to implement our international obligations. I think there's certainly arguments saying we should not be limited by international law of war standards that were developed in a different era and that don't apply equally to our opponent. So I think there are those arguments. Again, he suggested that no, I mean, there is this internal desire for order and for understanding as part of, I think, the order that the military generally needs, right, to operate effectively. So again, I'm not sure it's clear. I mean, again, I think there are those who would say, no, this puts us at an unfair advantage if we're subject to the Geneva Conventions, which were meant to apply to states, and Al-Qaeda is not, or the other terrorists are not. Right? But there may be some competing both moral concerns and sort of internal management concerns that would compel us to want to incorporate international law and apply it to our military.
Well, thank you for coming.
All right, thank you.
Everybody wants sandwiches. There's still a lunch or pocket constitutions. Feel free to grab some. Thanks for coming out today. Thanks very much, Professor. Very interesting.
Oh, that's it. We have to broadcast. Thank you so much. Great time. I really appreciate that.
Very informative. Lots of stuff.
Okay.
Well,
thank
you.
Thank you.
Nice to hear something.
Well, thank you.
Oh, yeah.